Pittsburgh up next. Support for WGTD's morning show is provided by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about adult, undergraduate, and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. Support for WGTD's morning show also comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea is a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today is the monthly visit of the United Environmental Council, and Nan Calvert has a very interesting guest with her, and we'll get to that in the morning. Just a quick word about the upcoming morning shows. Tomorrow, I am reconnecting with Mark Cushman, and all of you Star Trek fans, I think, will enjoy tomorrow's morning show. We talk about the third and final volume of his series of books devoted to the original series of Star Trek called These Are the Voyages, in which he takes us on a fascinating behind-the-scenes examination of each and every episode, how they took shape, and also gives us the overall story of Star Trek in its earliest days as it first became a phenomenon here in America, and for that matter, around the world. Monday is Martin Luther King Day, and from the archives, you'll hear a conversation I recorded with someone who helped coordinate the historic March on Washington, and actually helped coordinate the transportation, which allowed thousands of people to stream into Washington, D.C., to hear, among other things, Martin Luther King's remarkable I Have a Dream speech. And on Tuesday, we're hoping to preview for you a remarkable documentary airing Tuesday night on PBS's American Experience series devoted to the great American inventor, Thomas Alva Edison. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. We remind you of the Morning Show archive, which is on our website, WGTD.org. Click on Talk. Again, on today's program, we're happy to have back in the studios Nan Calvert, as always, for these monthly visits of the UEC. And with her today is a young man by the name of Cody McDonald, who is project coordinator with the Ozaukee Washington Land Trust. But he is here actually wearing another hat, primarily to talk about something which he is helping to facilitate, an EPA Great Lakes Restoration Grant designed to combat aquatic invasive species. And Nan, well, we welcome both of you, and Cody especially, our newcomer to the morning show. Nan, because he has something to do with invasive species, it's, I guess, no surprise that you and Cody McDonald should have crossed paths at some point. Tell us how the two of you first met.
Well, actually, I found out about Cody almost a year ago when someone that he knows came out to Sino to investigate it as a venue for her wedding. She works with the Ozaukee Washington Land Trust as well. And so we started talking about land trusts and things that we do, and she mentioned that Cody would be a really good person to have on the radio. So I got in touch with Cody, and here he is. And I was particularly interested in having him be on the radio, not only to talk about the Great Lakes Restoration, but also to help people understand what land trusts are. Wisconsin is very lucky. We have a number of land trusts here, and they all operate in a slightly different manner, but they all have the same goal, and that is to set aside viable, functioning open space in perpetuity. It's sort of the vanguard for doing that, because without that effort and without that understanding, things would disappear very, very quickly. And land trusts, even though they're all structured a little bit differently and they operate a little bit differently, many of them are involved in very, very important land restoration projects and all manner of things. So I particularly wanted Cody here to help people understand that. And by the way, happy 2015 to you and everybody.
This is a nice way to start out the new year. So so we're glad to have you back. And Cody, again, we welcome you into our studios. Let's learn a little bit about you personally before we find out about some of this work that you're doing professionally. You were telling me before we went on the air that you are from West Bend originally.
Yeah, that's correct. I'm from West Bend. I went to high school there.
What were you interested in then, back in those days? I can't imagine you were interested in land trusts back in high school.
I was trying to figure it all out, yeah. Oh. I've always had an interest in sports, and I actually did take a greater liking to my science classes in high school, which led me to, it was kind of a path I wanted to take, which led me to University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point, where I ended up going to school there for college. And I got a degree in land use planning, which is part of the natural resource management side of things.
Now, how does someone at that tender young age get interested in something like that? I mean, how did that even cross your path as a possibility?
I mean, growing up, I've always just felt right at home and most relaxed and stress-free just in the environment, enjoying open spaces like parks that communities have to offer. And so I went to Stevens Point just for that reason, knowing that they had a really good environmental program. Hmm. And the land use planning program in particular was interesting to me because it allows you to work with communities to kind of shape what you would like that community to look like within the next, say, 15 to 30 years. And so you try to work with different partnering organizations and folks in the community to kind of guide them on their way and kind of shape the land for its best use.
You were mentioning that ahead of taking this job, which brought you pretty much back home, you actually spent at least one semester towards the end of your time, I think at Stevens Point, in Nepal.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
That was a great way to cap off my college career. That was actually, I studied abroad in Nepal at the Chitwan National Forest, and that was through the University of Minnesota, Twin Cities. And it was the first year program that we ever did over there, and we were studying community forestry and working with local communities over there to kind of assess the levels of sustainability and how they were managing their forests, and also working with pilot studies like Project Red, I believe, was a carbon credit program, and basically trying to make conservation profitable for these local communities and community forest organizations.
Wow.
So, yeah.
That sounds quite challenging on a couple different levels, but one of them is just that scenario of an outsider coming in and trying to help, for instance, the people of Nepal make sense of some really vexing issues. That's hard enough to do when you're doing it in your own country, but sort of to come in from the outside and make sense of it, I don't think that, I can't imagine that was very easy.
No, it was difficult. It was quite a culture shock. Landing in Kathmandu, for me, it was my first time ever outside of the U.S., so kind of just thrown into the fire a little bit. But it actually did help. The first 6 weeks were spent just learning the local language. And so once we were able to grasp that a little more, you could actually speak to these organizations and folks in their native tongue, which, you know, and once you can do that, you know, granted we were just learning, it's a little more sign of respect to you that you're trying to learn their language. And so we were able to communicate a little more easier.
So at some point then you graduate from Stevens Point, and of all the places you might have landed, you end up landing back home.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I actually I got an internship with the Land Trust, so in the summer of 2013, right after I graduated, and that was a stewardship technician internship. And so I was working hand-in-hand with our stewardship director to oversee the 24 properties that we own and manage. And so these are dynamic preserves. Everyone's a little bit different. And so it was interesting learning the different techniques of how to try to keep up with all that. And we have a youth corps of anywhere from 5 to 10 high school kids that work with us every summer. So working with them and trying to teach them daily stewardship activities and learn a little bit about grant writing and such, and just about nonprofit land trusts in general. So
yeah, and I think we will, as Nan was saying, it's important for us to maybe talk a little bit about how land trusts function and how yours functions, and maybe we can find out a little bit about any interesting differences between yours and the Kenosha Racine Land Trust, for instance. What are your specific responsibilities as project coordinator? What does that term even mean?
Yes, project coordinator. In 2012. The Ozaukee Washington Land Trust applied for a Great Lakes Restoration Initiative grant. And that's an EPA-funded grant. And we were awarded that grant, so it's just over $500,000. It's now turned into a three-year grant on a six-county project region. And the objective by this September of 2015 is to have treated and protected over 1,500 acres of wetland, riparian, and shoreline habitat from the invasion of mainly for more wetland invasive species.
So as project coordinator, you are coordinating that effort then specifically.
Exactly. Yep. The stewardship director, Mike Hoffer, helps oversee the budget, and it's my responsibility to make sure that we meet our deliverables. So it's a lot. It's a lot to keep up with.
Yeah, sounds like it. Well, and that's something we'll explore in just a couple of minutes and talk about some of the specific invasives that you are in your crosshairs, so to speak. Nan, why don't we turn back to you, since you have such a long history with land trusts, to just kind of spell out a very general kind of definition about what a land trust is. And then we can explore some of the ways in which Kenosha Racine Land Trust and Ozaukee Washington Land Trust, how they operate.
Oh, sure. I'd love to do that. So a land trust organization, and sometimes they're called conservancies, their goal is to help set aside land, and we are not afraid of using the word in perpetuity, for current and future generations. That's part of our mission as the Kenosha Racine Land Trust. And every single land trust does that, and they all do it in slightly different ways. Some land trusts have the capacity to purchase land outright. Some land trusts work with private landowners, and landowners can then donate their land to the land trust. So it can be structured in many different ways, and it's often done very creatively to get the job done. One of the biggest myths about land trusts is that when a person puts their land into trust, say a private landowner, that they lose the ability to control that land. And nothing could be farther from the truth. So, for example, a lot of our listeners, I'm sure, know Brighton Woods Orchard. It's a very popular place here in southeastern Wisconsin. And the Kenosha Racine Land Trust worked with the owner of Brighton Woods Orchard to put that land into trust. So that means that the landowner structures a very specific and unique document that spells out exactly what is to happen to that land. And so, of course, so Brighton Woods will always remain a productive farmland. And, of course, there's beautiful woodland on that property, too. But what it means is that it's not going to turn into a parking lot. It's not going to turn into something that's paved over and turfed over. We have a number of private landowners with whom we've worked to structure their easements. And it can be so specific as to require that the buildings on the property never expand their footprint. They may be able to go up one story, but they don't get any bigger. It may include keeping it historically accurate. It may include having land remain in agricultural production, and then once it goes out of production for whatever reason, it might have to be restored as a wetland. That document, that easement, travels with that land in perpetuity, regardless of who owns it. So, for example, if I had a piece of property and I had an easement structured to my liking, excuse me, that easement would go through the generations with whomever owned it. I can sell it to whomever I desire, but they have to honor that document.
And those specifics are crafted by the person who owns the land.
Exactly. So, and you know, this is a big deal. We're not talking about what do you want to see happen 5 or 10 years from now. We're talking about, you know, 25, 50. How would you like to see this land passed down as a legacy in your community or in your family? So, it takes a while to get those structured so that people feel very comfortable with what's happening. And again, whoever owns that land is bound by that agreement.
It sometimes reminds me of the designation that is sometimes given to structures here in town when a place is designated as some sort of historic landmark.
Yes.
And, of course, attached to that designation is not just a pretty plaque by the front door, but the understanding then that you can't just do anything. I mean, you especially can't come in with a wrecking ball, but you also can't take this structure and transform it in ways that debase its legacy.
Exactly. So in terms of a building and having its legacy preserved, when you think about the land, this is a living legacy that we're preserving. And so really what we're trying to do, particularly with regard to land that isn't under agricultural production and no one is living on it, what we're trying to do is restore the ecosystems on those properties so that they remain viable and functional and do what they're supposed to do. So, for example, the Kenosha Racine Land Trust owns some really wonderful property along the Des Plaines River, along the freeway just south of Highway 50. And so what we are doing is working very hard to, you know, make that a functional, viable riparian zone, a wetland, because as anybody knows, that's a highly urbanized area for the most part, lots of impervious surface, and we need all of the functioning wetland that we can get along that area. But we also need to preserve that habitat because it's really quickly disappearing. Wetlands are our most endangered, or one of our most endangered habitats, and they perform an essential function for us. So again, you know, all land trusts work a little bit differently. Some of them are all volunteer organizations. Some of them have paid staff or a combination thereof. People always think that we're a government entity, which we're not. but, you know, of course, we write for grants in order to fund the things we do. So it might be an EPA grant or it might be a NACA grant or, you know. We also work very closely with municipalities on pieces of property that are very important to that region or that area.
So you are part of Kenosha Racine Land Trust.
I am.
And what is your position with them?
Well, actually, interestingly enough, the Kenosha Racine Land Trust last year merged with Sino Woodland Education Center. And, right. and it was a perfect merger because both the Sino property and our sister property, Drumlin Farm, were many decades ago put into trust. The two women who owned them, Dr. Elvira Sino and Dr. Shirley Peterson, way back when, before people were setting aside land in this manner, realized that they had something pretty amazing, and they wanted to make certain that future generations would benefit from this and that it wouldn't become urbanized. And so they set their land aside in perpetuity to be used for environmental education and also for forestry. So just because you set your land aside doesn't mean that it isn't used for the benefit of all in some way, shape, or form that doesn't necessarily have to do with canoeing or hiking or native plants. It can be a functioning farm. So we're essentially a tree farm, if you will, but we do forestry on both of those properties. And it's open to the public, and people can come out and hike and see beautiful habitats, but it's also a functioning business, if you will. So because of the legacy of setting that land aside, it seemed really perfect for Sino Woodland Education Center and the Land Trust to merge and form one strong and united organization to carry that mission forward of land preservation, but also education and forestry as well.
Great. And what is your position specifically?
My position is the Director of Education. So I get to teach people about the land and plants and the animals that live there and about forestry. I'm certainly still learning about forestry. It's fascinating. And, thing in society where it says, you know, you can't cut down any trees. But, you know, if you didn't, our buildings are made out of trees and so many other things are made out of wood and food products come from wood and all of those kinds of things. So it's a really great opportunity to learn how we depend on these giant organisms for our lives and our livelihood. And so that's what I do.
Very good. So from what you know, let's talk to Cody about his land trust, and then we can just kind of get a sense of some contrasts maybe. So again, Cody, how long have you been with Ozaukee Washington Land Trust?
Just over a year at this point.
Okay. So you're probably not the resident historian of the organization, but
right.
Well, what can you tell us about how long it's been around? Do you know very much about that?
Yeah, I believe the organization was started back in the early 90s. And when we did start out, it was just the Ozaukee Land Trust. I believe it was either late 90s or early 2000s, they realized that there's more opportunity if we do combine entities into the Ozaukee Washington Land Trust. If you increase your project area like that, the number of partners that you get to work with increase, you can get a lot more done. So, as far as our executive director, Sean Groff, and our land protection director, Steve Hankel, these guys work around the clock in pursuit of land acquisition, right, and conservation easements, as Nan said. So right now we own and manage I believe it's 24 properties. We're actually in the process of acquiring like three more properties within the next month or so. So we're still growing, and we have over 50 conservation easements with private property owners. And so part of the projects that I'm more involved in on our properties are these restoration projects that Nan was talking about. So if we acquire a piece of land that was in agriculture, but maybe part of the agreement, if DNR had any part of the acquisition, is they want us to restore that piece of land into perhaps what it once was pre-settlement. You know, what did that piece of land look like pre-settlement? Was it a wetland? Was it oak savanna? Was it, you know, maple-dominant forest and such? And so we'll go after these grants to pursue those restoration opportunities. So an example of that is one of the best examples is our Forest Beach Migratory Preserve. So it used to be Squire's Golf Club up in Belgium in Ozaukee County. And this is right on Lake Michigan. And so this is prime habitat for mainly migratory birds. Lake Michigan is a huge flyway zone where migratory birds, it's essential that they have habitat to, you know, stop and rest and forage for food and just maintain their health for the long journeys that they're traveling. And so we restored this golf course into a migratory bird preserve. And I believe Forest Beach is, it's about 74-acre preserve, again, right on the shoreline of Lake Michigan. And there's about 11 different kinds of habitat there to promote habitat for different kinds of migratory bird species, ranging from there's grassland and prairie. There is an oak savanna that we're trying to manage with tools such as prescribed burns. There's forests that we're maintaining, and there's a huge cohort of wetlands and ponds that were restored back into the property. Mm-hmm. So
in this case, was this a golf course that essentially went out of business for one reason or another?
Yeah, that was my understanding of it.
Before you came along, I suppose.
Yeah, it was before my time, right, but I believe the golf course was not in the best state, and this was a proposed use that the Land Trust could move in and really provide a valuable open space to not only, you know, migratory birds, but all of our preserves that we own and manage are open to the public, too. So we maintain a really nice trail system throughout the majority of our properties, and it's just a paradise for birders and such, and people just enjoy walking around outside.
So you've already partly answered this question, which was, what do you mean by maintain? When you said we maintain these 24 properties, does that just mean mowing the lawn? And obviously it means a lot more than mowing the lawn and trimming the hedges. And part of, I suppose, what's tied up in that is when you first acquire a project, mm-hmm. if that project is a restoration project to take what it is and turn it into what it used to be, mm-hmm. that I'm sure is a complicated process and maybe sometimes a long process.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. Some of these projects that we embark on are really time consuming. It's a long term commitment. And so maintaining a preserve can go from anywhere to, like you said, mowing the trails and keeping those maintained. Also includes in keeping invasive species down. So these are organisms that come from a foreign environment that are introduced into an area where they mainly take over and cause harm to, you know, environmental, economic, and social factors. So trying to keep invasive species down to manageable levels in your preserve so the native organisms have room to thrive. Another preserve we have, which is Riverbend Preserve, we planted over 8,000 trees there the first summer that I came on as an intern. So once you do that, you're committing yourself to, you know, maintaining those 8,000 trees. And that's a lot of work. And we get a lot of this work done with a big group of volunteers, though, that, you know, come in and help out and enjoy these kind of stewardship projects. So
I'm especially curious about that, about the trees. I mean, some people would just say, well, don't you just plant trees and then let nature do its thing? But I suppose there's a lot more involved when you were really trying to care for them and make sure they really thrive. What are we talking about?
Yeah, so there's a lot you can do. One of the first things that I wanted to do once you know, have a project where you're planting 8,000 trees is to set up a monitoring protocol for that stand. You know, have a random sample of 100 trees that you mark, 1 through 100, and just monitor their growth rates and their condition. You know, if you're seeing any signs of stress or whatnot, you know, mark these things and measure their effectiveness or your effectiveness of managing that plot as the years go on. Some other things for tree maintenance is keeping little critters out like rabbits and deer browse is a pretty bad problem, especially in the metropolitan area that we have our preserves in. So there's different things like fencing that can go around these trees. And if you have any, you know, drought-like summers, keeping them moist and such like that. So. Mm.
Yeah. So just the way you would nurture anything that's in your garden, I suppose, in a sense, right. But some complicated things are at play. Yeah. Now, what's involved, and Nan, please chime in, when you have a piece of land and you want to do something else with it, for instance, if you want to restore it to more of kind of a prairie savanna kind of thing, is that a simpler matter? Or does that require the same kind of intense maintenance?
Not so much. Yeah, the maintenance is pretty intense. All depending on site conditions and in the area of the planting. And so your best friend when you do want to manage an area for prairie is called a prescribed burn. You know, this fire is your best friend. Hmm. And what fire does to an area, a prescribed burn, is if woody invasives or small trees and shrubs are starting to move in, a fire can get so hot where it eventually will burn that woody material off. And all that's growing there is this prairie seed that was planted. And it also requires, in the first 3 years or so of a planting, there's a pretty intense mowing regime. So you want to, there's going to be weeds that try to move in and such. And so a good timed mowing regime can help to keep those weeds out and help those natives that you planted shoot up a little more. And so anything else?
Well, you know, a very careful and judicious application of herbicides also very helpful. I know there's a lot of backlash about glyphosate and Roundup and all that sort of thing. But in the hands of people that know what they're doing and know how to apply it and when to apply it in a very targeted manner, it's an essential tool in land management and land restoration, as is mowing. But really, burning is the thing that gets you going. It does so many things. It helps to get rid of those woody species. It can certainly do in a lot of invasive species seeds and the root structure. But it also releases nutrients into the soil. And some of our native plant species, their seeds require heat in order to germinate. So it's not just a cool thing to do. It really does have an actual scientific purpose for that happening. And I just wanted to chime in, you know, when we have a piece of land that we'd really like to restore, there's a process whereby you do something called a baseline report. What do you have now? What's in place right now? What do you need to get rid of, and what can you work with? And that also involves determining what it might have been in the pre-settlement. You know, not everything was a prairie. We had oak savannas, and those are highly endangered, highly fragile habitats, very fragmented. And so anytime we can get an oak savanna back online, if you will, that's always a win for us. So there's and then you have a very detailed land management plan that goes, you know, 5 years out and whatnot. So
in general, does one always restore a land to what it was? I mean, is that the only thing that makes sense if you're going to transform a plot of land? Does it ever make sense to take a plot of land that once was a prairie and turn it into a forest or turn it into a wetlands? I mean, or is that just not, is that an impossibility? I mean, are you, in a sense, dictated by what that land is, its contours and so on?
I think that, you know, I learned early on, you know, the pre-settlement rule. What did this area look like pre-settlement? But landscapes change over time, and you have to stay within the guidelines of, again, where these communities want to go and such, and you have to deal with things like development. And so it's not always a realistic goal to manage a preserve to what it looked like pre-settlement. And also dealing with things like capacity, taking on a piece of land and trying to convert it back into oak savanna or prairie, it's a long-term commitment, and it requires, you know, most of the times grants that you have to receive to keep up with these. So sometimes we'll get a preserve, and the greatest thing about that preserve is that it's preserved for perpetuity, and so it's always there. If it's not this gorgeous piece of land yet, you know, it's we have time to maintain it, but just basic things like, again, keeping invasives out and maintaining a nice trail system so the public can enjoy that piece of property. It all depends on your management goal and the capacity of what you have. So.
For those of you just joining us, today is the monthly visit of the United Environmental Council. And, of course, Nan Cavert is on hand. And with us, our special guest is Cody McDonald, who is project coordinator with the Ozaukee Washington Land Trust. And that term project coordinator actually refers to a Great Lakes Restoration Grant, which his land trust has been given, which involves the targeting of some aquatic invasive species. Ahead of us talking about that, what about when you are given land, Nanya, I think you were referring to this land that the Kenosha Racine Land Trust has that you hope to or have or in the process of converting into wetlands. What's involved in doing that? That just on the surface sounds like the most complicated thing one could do with a piece of land as opposed to planting trees or planting grass.
Well, actually, it already is a wetland. It's just degraded partly because of reed canary grass and other invasive species, but that's the dominant vegetation there. So it'll be a long-term process of managing out, to the degree that we can, managing out the reed canary grass and helping to restore species there, not only plant species, but also mammalian and bird species as well, because the higher diversity of plant species you have, the better diversity of other, you know, two-legged and four-legged things. So it'll be a challenge. Reed canary grass is always a challenge, but, you know, you got to try and get it done.
So what you're referring to is again, something that is still a wetlands, but kind of like a wounded wetlands,
exactly.
And you're trying to revive it then.
Exactly.
Now, is it ever possible to restore a wetland that isn't a wetland anymore?
Oh, sure. Yeah. It's a bit more of an involved process.
And what are we talking about?
Well, you know, it might involve some topographic changes if things have been drained and filled and or flattened and you know, whatnot. So it's a bit more of an involved process. But the process is still the same. Manage out the invasive species, restore the hydrology of the area in whatever way you can. It might mean, you know, getting rid of the drain tiles that were put in a farm field to drain that off and just getting rid of those and let water come back onto the land. But you know, it's essentially all the same process. Get rid of the invasive species, restore the hydrology of an area, and then manage.
Right. Start whacking those weeds.
Exactly.
So, Cody McDonald, tell us about the reason why this EPA Great Lakes Restoration Grant was even applied for. Was there already a piece of land in place that was in trouble? And if so, what kind of trouble was it in?
I think the Land Trust was just interested in pursuing that opportunity in general. It'd be an incredible project to take on, in a sense where they drew the grant up to, you know, treat and protect 1,500 acres of wetland or shoreline riparian habitat. And so if you can reach that deliverable, you're making ground on a huge area. Again, it's a 6-county-wide project. And so the four plants that we're managing, The most prevalent of the four is a plant called Phragmites. Other people may know it as a common reed grass. Once you know what it looks like, you can't miss it. It's all over, especially on roadsides, wetlands again. And the other three plants are purple loosestrife, which is another notorious wetland invasive species.
It has such a pretty name. It's hard to believe
it
could be evil.
Ugly, ugly, ugly.
Yeah, it actually is a cool-looking plant, too.
No, it's not.
A lot of invasive species are aesthetically appealing, which is why, in some cases, again, they are prevalent, because if they're on the market and they are aesthetically appealing, you know, your average homeowner might buy that to put it in their garden, or, you know.
Or certainly allow it to remain, because,
right.
Yeah, I mean, unless you're Nan Calvert, no, you know, it's something you wouldn't mind looking at.
But, right. Right.
Or so. Cody.
Yeah, right, yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, I have ran into that where it's, you know, Japanese knotweed is another plant that we're managing. This plant grows very tall and very dense. And so you'll find this on some private properties, and it's outlining their lawn. And it's like, how did that get there? And they're like, well, we wanted a privacy barrier, and this was the perfect plant.
Oh.
And they just didn't know the consequences of planting that. So.
Right. And then the fourth?
The fourth is limegrass, which is a intertidal dune grass that grows on the beaches, the shoreline of Lake Michigan mainly.
Oh.
Yeah.
So these are invasive species, and I suppose the main consequence is that they are choking out other things that you would rather have there. Is that right?
Yep. They outcompete. They all have characteristics that allow them to outcompete native vegetation. And native vegetation has evolved with this landscape, and it works. Things work. You know, wildlife have evolved with native vegetation. So once an invasive species comes into the area and takes over, it kind of throws off that system. And so the plant, like Phragmites, its roots are called rhizomes. So these are roots that grow laterally underground, and about every 6 inches to a foot of that root growing laterally sprouts a new plant, and then that plant grows rhizomes. So it's like a clone. That's one characteristic it has. It also grows very tall and very dense, and it grows very fast. And so with those characteristics, any plant that doesn't, you know, have that is outcompeted. And when that happens, habitat becomes degraded. It's not as suitable for a majority of wildlife that's used in this area. There's also a huge economic point to be made about invasive species. Once a stand gets out of control, again, it's a long-term investment to get that stand eradicated or managed. You talk about things like shoreline property. A plant like Phragmites will take over shoreline property if given the opportunity. And Japanese knotweed, for example, over in Europe, they have such a bad problem with Japanese knotweed where if you're trying to sell your property and the plant is present, lots will go unsellable. You can't sell them because wow. the plant is so problematic. The roots on Japanese knotweed can actually grow through concrete infrastructure. So you talk about the foundation of a home, or if it's growing next to a roadside, it can, you know, it can upheave roadside concrete.
Wow, stuff, so. It's like a bad science fiction movie.
Yeah, wow. yeah. So there is a huge economic, you know, understanding and undertaking when you are managing invasive plants as well.
Wow. So what is this grant from the EPA being spent on? I mean, whatever resources they are giving to mm-hmm. the Ozaukee Washington Land Trust, how is that money being spent in mm-hmm. a sense? I guess another way to ask it is what are the strategies, maybe the additional strategies that are made possible because of this grant?
Right. So with an area of 1,500 acres, that's our end deliverable that we want to, you know, work in and protect. We can't do that all on our own. And so what we want to do is we want to identify partnering organizations within our six-county project region that we're supposed to be working on public and protected land. So they have to fall within those two categories. And just kind of reaching out to organizations such as other nonprofit land trusts or local units of government, like a county park system that manages open space. Kind of creating these partnerships and just identifying if they do have the four invasive species present that we're after. If they do, how can we equip that partner with what they need to take on that project themselves? Do we have to can we fund that project for them and they implement the work? Can we buy them equipment so they're prepared to take on the project? Or in other ways, there's projects that are so huge where we have to bring in a professional consultant company. Mm. And so, but this is good because we're working with about seven different consultant firms right now within these six counties. So there's a lot of business going around and there's a lot of different people that you get to work with. And so other things, educational workshops. Eradication is the goal, but the more people that know about invasive species, you know, the easier the problem's going to be to solve. And so we're trying to put on educational workshops, such as a workshop called Project Red. This is Riverine Early Detection is what that stands for. And that was created by the River Alliance of Wisconsin. And basically how that works is we partner up with another organization that it works best if they have a big group of volunteers that are interested in learning more about invasive species. And so the partnering organization hosts this workshop. It's a day event. Half of it's spent inside, just kind of following a PowerPoint. Second half of the day is spent outside actually searching for these invasive plants and showing people how to manage that and how to report an infestation if they find it. Hmm. So the partner hosts the event. The DNR brings in an instructor to teach the event, and then we fund the event.
Okay.
So, wow. Yeah.
And I can see just the way you've described that. That sounds like that could really get a lot of people excited about this, including young people. I
mm-hmm.
mean,
right.
Where suddenly it's not about chopping down weeds or even chopping down perfectly lovely looking plants, but it's about right. Battling back against an infestation. I mean, just right. you know, and those are good terms to use, but I mean that really starts to make it sound more like a battle that you're waging.
Right.
And that's really what it is.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's a lot to keep up with, but you're one of the best management approaches to managing invasive species is early detection and prevention, right? So if you can prevent an area from ever hosting an invasive species, that's the best approach because, you know, you're not spending as much funding on that project. It's not requiring as many resources. The smaller the stand, the less amount of herbicide you're using, if you do have to use herbicide. And so that usually, again, entails outreach. You know, let's educate the public on invasive plants so they can, you know, not introduce these plants to a new area accidentally. And monitoring, you know, let's keep the nice sites nice.
Right.
You know, staying out there, and some of the best days of work is conducting an inventory, paddling these, you know, stretches of river and just searching for invasive plants, marking presence data and stuff like that. So
where are you in this 3-year period? It's a 3-year grant, right?
Yep, it was a 2-year grant originally. We got a year-long extension on it to keep these projects going. And so we're entering that last year. The grant is going to be complete in this September of 2015. So we've reached our goal of protecting and treating 1,500 acres. We've reached that deliverable. Now we're just following up on, in conjunction with our partners, there's been about 65-plus projects that have happened. And these aren't just 65 individual projects. So one of those projects is a project held with the Wisconsin Department of Transportation and 3 county highway departments. And so we were working with Milwaukee County, Racine County, and Kenosha County highway departments, along with DOT, to treat phragmites along the frontage road right-of-ways of I-94. And so that again, is just one project of the 65. And It's a big undertaking.
Right. That in and of itself is quite a huge one. Wow.
Right.
Well, it sounds like good things are happening, and Nan has this big smile on her face because you're singing her song when you talk about all this.
Well, you know, it's just a testimony to the great good that land trusts can accomplish. And that's why I think it's so very important for people to have some sort of a working knowledge of what a land trust does. And if you have a land trust near you or in your community, your support of that land trust is essential in order to help it continue to function.
Very good. Cody McDonald, it's been great to meet you. If people want more information about the Ozaukee Washington Land Trust, do you folks have a website?
Yes, we do have a website. It is www.owlt.org.
Very good. It's been great to meet you. Great to have you here on the morning show. Very best wishes to you.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Nan, you have any events you want to tell us about?
Boy, do we have events. Yes, we do. I hope everybody has a calendar and a pencil or a pen handy. So here's an early sort of advanced notice. On February 22nd, from 11 a.m. till 4 p.m., the Seno Kenosha Racine Land Trust Conservancy will be hosting an open house. It's free. Everyone is welcome. There will be tasty treats and hikes and things to make and take home. Get up close with our beautiful trees at Seno, and we have some really amazing trees. So I hope everybody will be able to attend. Sierra Club Southeast Gateway Group, two really important events, one of which is tonight at 6:30 at the Kenosha Northside Library. Architect James Chambers will explore the science behind the design of net zero homes. And their second event that people need to know about, January 22nd, there is a potluck supper at 5:30 with a discussion at 7 p.m. The title of the program is Studying Wisconsin, the Life of Increase Lapham. And so many people don't know about Increase Lapham and what he meant to conservation here in Wisconsin. A fascinating, amazing man.
I did an interview with a man who wrote a biography of him within the last year, and I that was a name I did not know till that interview. He is a fascinating figure in Wisconsin history. Absolutely.
So also for that event, the Life of Increase Lapham, your RSVP is required, and just go to the Southeast Gateway website, and there's an email address there for you, and you can also call if you have any questions. Pringle Nature Center is hosting Snow Day, fun for the whole family, which includes geocaching and snowshoeing on January 24th from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., and the cool thing about it is that it is free. Riverbend Nature Center, it is their MLK School Break Nature Camp, 9 to 3 p.m. this coming Monday. You have to register. It's $30 for members, $35 for non-members. Winter theme activities include hiking, making s'mores, and a campfire. And that's it. Well, that's not it, but that's what we have time for.
The thing about tonight, did you
I did say that. Should I say it again?
No. That's okay. I just want to make sure that happened. Great. Nan, thank you for your coordination of these visits to the morning show. We look forward to seeing you at some point in February and every month thereafter for 2015.
Oh, yes. It's truly my pleasure. Thank you so much.
And Cody McDonald, once again, thank you for joining us today on the morning show. It was fun to have you here.
Yep. Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow on the morning show, Star Trek fans will enjoy, I'm sure, my conversation with Mark Cushman talking about his third volume of books called These Are the Voyages, which chronicle each and every